wall. It finally exploded, throwing a nearby Northern Alliance tank high in the air, flipping it. The tank landed on three Afghan soldiers, and they lay dead beneath its green iron turret, their thin brown legs sticking out from underneath. Severson himself had been thrown airborne, punching and kicking within a gray cloud of dust. He didn't feel himself land, but he heard it. A whoomph that set every bone in his body ringing with a hollow, angry tune. Sergeant Dave Betts shook his head after he landed, trying to clear his thinking. He'd been catapulted some 60 feet, and at the end of his arc, he felt he was falling down a cool, dark cave. He smelled the dead animal stench of burned hair, and realized it was his own. The blast had scoured his face. Miraculously, only his eyelashes and mustache were gone. His nose hurt, where his Oakley sunglasses had melted. They, too, had disappeared. He looked at Bach and laughed, and even that hurt. Bach's hair was sticking straight up. His face was powdered completely white with dust. Only the whites of his eyes were visible, wet, with blood running from the corners in thin lines. Bach's ears were bleeding as well. Betts reached up and touched his own, and found blood there too. Betts was amazed at the impact he had endured. He turned and looked back up at the parapet, where he'd been standing when the bomb landed. Then Betts looked down at his waist. The lower half of his body had disappeared. He panicked and started digging at the pebbles and sand. His legs emerged, then his knees. The blast had buried him up to his belt in rubble. He realized that even the shirt on his back had been blown off. Betts looked around and couldn't find Severson. He heard Leahy moaning. He turned and saw Kevin in a heap at the bottom of the fort wall, which had collapsed inward in a pile of pebbles and sand. Kevin was twisted like a doll. He looked as if two fingers had reached down from the sky and shaken him until he broke. Oh man, not Kevin. Kevin Leahy was his buddy. Betts looked after him like a mother after a wayward son. His father-in-law was the commanding general of all U.S. Special Operations Forces operating in the world. Who was going to make that phone call? General Brown, your son-in-law was blown up by one of our own bombs. In the errant bombing, four British SBS soldiers, with whom U.S. Navy SEAL Stephen Bass was deployed, were also wounded. At least 80 Afghan soldiers suffered serious injury. Betts wiggled out of the loose grip of sand and chunks and stumbled over to Kevin. Then he started screaming for help. Everything was moving in slow motion. He couldn't tell if hours had passed since the explosion, or minutes. He stood there screaming for someone to help his friend. It was nearly noon. Betts worried they were about to be overrun by Taliban soldiers who could use the chaos of the moment to easily charge them. In a matter of minutes, the military campaign that was America's answer to the attacks that had terrorized New York and Washington, D.C., had gone terribly wrong. Mitchell looked across the fort and tried to see through the towering cloud of dust just what had happened. Shrapnel and debris whizzed past his head as he stared through his binoculars. Okay, he wondered, where did this thing hit? The entire northeast end of the fort was obscured by the dust cloud. He grabbed the radio and called, "Severson, this is Mitchell, over." Silence. "Severson, this is Mitchell, over." Nothing. Mitchell began to think that maybe Severson had been so close to the explosion that his eardrums had burst, and he'd been deafened. He called again. "Severson, This is Mitchell. Over. And then, more urgently, any station, do you copy? This is Mitchell. Over. One of the 10th Mountain soldiers, located at the wall along the highway, replied, go ahead, Mitchell. Relieved, Mitchell asked, what can you see? Do you have contact with anybody? The soldier then delivered the devastating news. The bomb had hit Severson's position. About this time, the dust was clearing, and with his binos, Mitchell could see a couple of guys rising up out of the rubble. They stood and started wandering around, dazed. He swallowed hard at the sight. Then he picked up the radio and ordered everybody to rally at the main gate. He grabbed his gear and ran. Betts looked up through blurred eyes. Coming for him and the other wounded men were 9 soldiers from the 10th Mountain Division. They had been crouched at their position behind a wall along a nearby road when the bomb hit. As the gray cloud boiled upward, they'd been shocked to hear the cries, "Oh my God, we may have killed the wrong people," rise up among some other Special Forces soldiers standing there. That was wrong. That was very, very wrong, yelled some of the Afghans. Wounded men, Afghan and some British SBS soldiers, were already stumbling from the fort's entrance, walking dazed like zombies, hair sticking up, faces white. Sergeant Jerry Higley, 26, looked up and saw the sky darken as the debris cloud drifted the several hundred yards toward their group. A loud, thwacking rain began to fall, as shrapnel and bits of the exploded building wheeled through the dusty air and hit around them. It looks like we're in for a bit of a scuffle, joked Higley's friend, Specialist Thomas Beers, 22, from Pennsylvania. They quickly piled into a minivan and sped toward the fort, jumping out at the front gate and scaling a set of stairs leading up to the wall's pathway, where, after a breathless run through Taliban gunfire, they found the bleeding and broken Dave Betts. When they arrived, Betts didn't know where he was, or even who he was. The soldiers, having swallowed their earlier fears, scooped up stocky, muscular Betts and the others, and walked with them arm in arm, dodging the furious gunfire, along a narrow catwalk on the top of the wall. Their movement was slow-going. The Taliban prisoners were taking the opportunity to pound the blown-up position. Machine gun fire zigzagged across the crumbling dry walls. Private First Class Eric Andreessen, who the day before had been leisurely reading a novel in his tent back at K2, thought for sure they'd be shot. Dazed and in shock, the wounded men sometimes tried running away, heading back down the path to the bombsite. Andreessen and his buddies chased after them, ducking as bullets smacked the wall at their back. Andreessen found the roar of the shooting relentless. Yet he was suddenly bathed in a soothing calm. Finally, he and the others struggled down a steep set of stairs near the main gate, where Doc McFarland was waiting. Kevin Leahy was near death and had to be resuscitated several times. All of the men had broken bones and concussions, but miraculously, they were alive. Severson had suffered, among other wounds, a broken hip and back. Sergeant Pete Bach, blood still running from his ears and from the corner of his eyes, wandered away from the aid station and found a truck with the keys in the ignition. After fumbling with the door for several minutes, too dazed to figure out how to open it, he managed to get inside and drive himself back to the Turkish schoolhouse, where he walked into the lobby, shocking everyone with his macabre, cartoon-like appearance. Everyone at the schoolhouse, hearing of the errant bomb strike over the radio, had thought all of the guys had been killed. After fully recuperating from their wounds, all four men would receive the Purple Heart and Bronze Star and return to active duty. As he headed toward the wounded men, Mitchell struggled under the 60 pounds of gear he'd stuffed in his load-bearing vest. The endless rope climbs, bench presses, and gut-wrenching 20-mile runs back at Fort Campbell were paying off. Mitchell felt like collapsing on the ground, but pushed himself ahead, one stride at a time. He tried raising the bombers on the radio. He had to stop them from dropping any more bombs. "Shasta 1-1," he said, using the plane's call sign. No reply. And then in the melee's confusion, he couldn't remember the call signs of any other planes. So he blurted out, "Any U.S. aircraft! Any U.S. aircraft! Cease fire! Cease fire! We have friendly casualties on the ground!" Finally, he heard a voice on the radio. "Roger, this is Shasta 1-1. I understand that you have U.S. casualties on the ground. Ceasing fire." And then the pilot asked Mitchell if he wanted him to stay in a holding pattern overhead, ready for another airstrike. Mitchell considered this, then said sadly, "Negative. We are done for the morning." He had to gather everyone, including Betts, Leahy, Severson, and Bach, and retreat to the schoolhouse. There they would make a new plan, to destroy the fort once and for all. Mike. He thought about Span, lying somewhere in the courtyard. We have to find Mike. Finding Span was now his mission. As the battle raged, Najib Qureshi caught a taxi in Mazar and rode out to Kala Ijangi to watch the mayhem. He stood outside the fortress on the main highway, along with several hundred other men, many of them armed. Every few minutes, another taxi would arrive from town, and another soldier would get out, leaning in to retrieve his long RPG tube from the back seat, pay the driver, and then trot off across the farm field leading to the towering fortress. Najib could feel the explosions of the bombs and mortars in his chest. The air crackled overhead with the passing of stray rounds, like a thousand snapping whips. He wanted to go inside and see for himself what was happening, but knew it was too dangerous. He was glad to see the Taliban receiving so much punishment from the American bombs. Inside the city, Nadir Sinhab, who had been beaten severely by the Taliban, and whose father's house had been dug up by vengeful Taliban soldiers, had climbed to the roof of a friend's house and watched the spectacle in the distance, the sky flashing like lightning as the daylight faded. The sound of the bombs falling rattled the windows in his friend's house. The sky was filled with black smoke. He saw a big plane, a B-52, fly overhead, very high. And then it dropped its guided bombs, and the fortress exploded. After a while, he went home. Nadir was sitting in his own house, when suddenly the walls exploded around him. A rocket had flown from the fortress, one of the hundreds that were exploding on their own in the fires burning in the courtyard, and crashed through the roof of his house, several miles from the fort. Nadir was the only one home, and when he regained consciousness in the rubble, he knew he was lucky to be alive. He was bleeding. He felt around at his back and found it wet. He tasted blood in his mouth. His legs were cut with shrapnel. He couldn't walk. He lay in the dust and fallen chunks of mud. Then his father rushed into the house and carried him outside to a car and drove off to the hospital in Mazar. The Afghan doctors bandaged him and sent him home later that night. Nadir smiled at the damage he knew the bombs must be inflicting upon the men who had tormented him during their occupation of his city. News of the errant bomb strike soon flashed across the airwaves in the United States. Carla Milo, Ben Milo's wife, heard it while she was up early, readying their three kids for school. She was standing at the ironing board in the living room when footage of the explosion flickered on the television. Almost simultaneously, the phone rang in the kitchen. It was a family friend of theirs, the wife of one of Ben's buddies from his days in the regular army, wanting to know if he'd been hurt in the bombing. Carla froze, standing there in her bathrobe, the iron poised in midair over the board. "I don't have a clue," she told the woman, and hung up. Then the phone rang again, and didn't stop, as the rest of the team wives called each other asking, "What have you heard? What do you know?" They didn't know anything. The wait over the next several days was excruciating. Usually, when something bad happened, when someone was killed or wounded in a training exercise or a training deployment overseas, it took at least a few days before anyone got an official account of what had happened. This was because the command wanted to positively identify who had been hurt, or who was now dead, before notifying the family. Not that the wives weren't able to figure out who was dead or hurt before this official confirmation. Carla just wished that Ben would call. The phone looked enormous as it hung in silence on the kitchen wall. After the errant bombing of Severson's position, Sontag and Mitchell decided to level the south courtyard with cannon fire from an AC-130 Spectre gunship. The two officers felt they were running out of time. The Taliban had to be smashed now. The enemy soldiers remained too sheltered in the various rooms, stables, and storehouses that dotted the courtyard, and they were able to rearm themselves too easily with the weapons and ammo lying around in the various nearby caches. The U.S. attack was planned for that night. Meanwhile, the Northern Alliance launched a daylight assault and began battling their way into the South Courtyard, yard by yard. Often the fighting was hand-to-hand. Ali Sarwar and several other men had started from the secure north end and crept along the narrow path lining the fortress wall, engaging in vicious firefights along the way. At one point, one of Sarwar's men stooped to reload in front of a small 6-inch opening in a mud wall and was shot in the stomach by a Taliban soldier. The man looked up in surprise and went tumbling down the wall into the fort. He lay at the bottom, moaning. Ali had to leave him behind as they pressed ahead. He and his men spent the night hiding in a house in the nearby village of Dededi, while the Spectre gunship pounded the fort. The Taliban's main store of weapons and ammunition was hit by one Spectre cannon shell, and it sent a fireball shooting several hundred yards in the air. The explosions could be seen by some of Sontag's men standing on the roof back at the Turkish schoolhouse, 11 miles away. The following morning, Ali and his men arrived at the southern end, behind the main parapet, the Taliban's remaining stronghold. They hacked their way through a mud wall into a small room, a makeshift guard shack that overlooked the wide parapet. They hacked quickly, because inside the room were Taliban soldiers who were firing across the fort into the north courtyard, and they wanted to take them by surprise. The Taliban soldiers turned to see Ali and his men, standing before them in a hole that had suddenly opened in the wall. Ali's men gunned the Taliban down and occupied the position, eventually moving out to the lip of the parapet, where they had a clear view of the remaining Taliban forces below in the south courtyard. The fighting grew so intense that Ali and other Alliance soldiers who joined them dragged the dead bodies of fallen soldiers in a pile and used them as barricades from which they could safely fight. After several hours, near dark, Ali and the rest of the Alliance force, now numbering several hundred men, were able to move down the sloping ramp into the south courtyard itself. from one of the horse stables, 50 yards to the east, across grassy, open ground. A Taliban started charging at the line of Alliance soldiers, screaming in rage, a war cry that was interrupted by a fusillade of gunfire. Still, the man continued running, a grenade clenched in one hand, held high over his head. Ali could see the man jerk as the bullets hit him, but he would not drop. He managed to reach one of Sarwar's men, stopping to heave his grenade. The heavy metal object sailed through the air and struck the soldier on the head, blowing up and killing him instantly. The Taliban soldier was finally cut down by a last long volley of fire. Ali's men walked another 100 feet through waist-high grass, when suddenly some 50 Taliban soldiers jumped up from hiding on the ground and opened fire, their AKs held at their hips, spraying bullets. When the shooting stopped, some 150 Taliban and Alliance soldiers lay dead. Bitter smoke and the cries of bleeding men drifted over the suddenly quiet courtyard. Somehow, Ali was unhurt. He cautiously thought, as he had back in the canyon when confronting the Taliban there and surviving, that his day to die still had not come. He continued moving through the fort, fighting and winning. Shannon Spann was visiting her parents' house in California when there was a knock at the front door. Standing outside was a grief team of 5 CIA employees. One of them was the paramilitary officer whom Mike had asked to be the person to deliver any bad news to Shannon. Shannon listened as the man spoke, but she could barely believe he was telling the truth. Mike couldn't be dead. The officers explained what had happened at Kala Ijangi, telling her that her husband had been shot. Shannon immediately thought of Mike's 2 young daughters and their own 6-month-old son. The girl's mother, Spann's first wife, was dying of cancer and wasn't expected to live much longer. Shannon resolved to remain steadfast, even when one of the girls later started crying and asked, "Who's going to teach Jake the daddy stuff?" By November 28th, Ali Sarwar and the rest of the Alliance soldiers had captured the southern courtyard. The area was shaded by pine trees, whose shaggy trunks had been shattered and pockmarked by bullets. Severed tree limbs lay on the ground. Nearby stood a tiny mosque, its smooth white walls defiled by hundreds of bullet holes. The pink house, too, was pocked by gunfire, and thousands of tiny pink chunks of concrete were scattered on the hard ground. That morning, General Dostum and his troops returned to reclaim the fort as their own. Dostum had driven back from Kunduz the night before, with now prisoner Mullah Faisal in tow, along with Dean, Nelson, and Bowers. Freelance video cameraman Dodge Billingsley, who had been inside the fort filming much of the battle, had been asleep in his hotel in downtown Mazar when he heard Dostum's armored column roll past along the main street, shaking all the windows in the building. Billingsley got out of bed and went to the balcony. He counted about 6 troop carriers, several large cargo trucks, and an assortment of Toyota Land Cruisers. He guessed that the warlord would not be happy when he finally reviewed the damage the Taliban had inflicted upon his headquarters. At the fort, Dostum grabbed Mullah Faisal, the Taliban general with whom he had negotiated the ultimately perfidious surrender, and shoved him along on a tour of the destruction. Also in tow were hundreds of news reporters and television cameras, capturing Dostum's furious glare as he pointed out the physical damage, as well as the piles of dead bodies strewn everywhere. The stench of death was overpowering. As the soldiers and reporters walked around the southern courtyard, a number of Taliban prisoners were still trapped in the basement of the Pink House. None of the Alliance or American soldiers knew exactly how many were there. Estimates ranged from a handful to several hundred. No matter the number, it was clear to everyone that they were refusing to surrender. In the basement, the prisoners sitting near the air vents and holes that had been punched in the foundation could hear the anxious, upbeat voices of their guards, who believed they had killed most everyone below. In fact, the prisoners were still armed with rifles, mortars, and grenades, and they were considering rushing up the stairs and attacking. Up top, Dostum angrily asked Faisal, "Did you know anything about this?" The Taliban leader shook his head, "No." Dostum, surveying the human carnage, told one reporter that he was sick of death. Soon the Red Cross would begin hauling away seemingly innumerable bodies that would be buried in a mass grave outside the city. Back in his headquarters office, Dostum held court, looking beyond the messiness of the battle to his political future. He explained that he wanted to build a new country. Women should be educated, he said, and he insisted that they would have representation in the new government. He further explained that he wanted to spend more time with his family. Back in the basement of the Pink House, the last Taliban fighters waited and considered making one final attack. In an effort to get the remaining prisoners to surrender, the Alliance soldiers began to throw rockets and grenades into the basement through jagged holes they'd hacked in the brick foundation. Periodically, men also walked up and jammed their gun barrels into the holes and emptied their clips. Still, there was no sign of surrender. At one point, several foreign aid workers had started walking down the long stairs to the basement and were shot by machine gun fire. After they were bandaged up, all concerned decided that no more such trips would be attempted. Dostum's men next poured fuel oil through the holes and then set fire to it. Down below, men were burned alive. Others pressed against the wall, away from the licking flames. Still, no surrender. Finally, Ali Sarwar found a shovel and axe and started digging a trench all the way across the southern courtyard. A small stream entered the fort at the southwest corner. In prosperous pre-Taliban times, the water had been used to irrigate fertile plots of corn and cucumber that dotted the fort. Sarwar was now diverting the stream so that it flowed to the Pink House. Someone in his group hacked another hole in the brick foundation, which opened at ceiling level in the basement below. Just then, a prisoner pointed a gun barrel out of the new hole and fired, hitting some of Sarwar's men in the ankles. They crumpled and had to be quickly dragged away to an aid station. Soon, however, the current of muddy brown water was lapping against the building and then slurping through the hole in the foundation. Freezing water started filling the basement. After a day, just 13 Taliban soldiers had emerged from the basement. The water had risen inside to nearly 7 feet, causing the men inside to dog paddle as their heads brushed the ceiling. A majority of them who were wounded or sick drowned. The room became a slurry of human body parts, excrement, even raw horse meat, which some of the men had been eating, having hacked pieces off some of the dead animals lying in the courtyard. Seeing that the basement was now flooded to a depth of about 8 feet, leaving 2 feet of airspace, Ali Sarwar and his men shut off the water supply. as the water drained through the porous soil floor below them. The surviving men, freezing and delirious, took a vote as to whether they would surrender. They could either die in this stinking hole, or they could die in the sunlight above, on firm ground. At least by surrendering, they would have a chance of living. To remain in the room was to surely tempt being flooded again. So it was that 4 days after Mitchell had tried leveling the Pink House with fusillades of bombs, 86 wet and miserable Taliban prisoners walked up from the basement, blinking in daylight, many of them, for the first time in 7 days. John Walker Lind was among them. Shortly after the fighting had begun, he'd been shot in the leg and lay in the courtyard as the battle raged around him. Finally, he was dragged by others into the basement. There he had feared for his life, both at the hands of the soldiers firing from above, and from his fellow prisoners hunkered in the dark room. For the first several days of the battle, any talk of surrender was silenced by Lynn's hard-line comrades in the group. Lynn feared getting shot in the back if he made a break upstairs to what he hoped would be freedom. He felt he had no choice but to remain in the basement and hope for the best. As the fort was secured, Ben Milo finally called his wife, Carla, back in Tennessee. He had been shaken by the errant bombing at the fort, as well as the savagery of the battle within its walls. Ben knew Carla would be worrying about him, given all the extremely bad news. She knew it was Ben calling, because the words Fort Campbell lit up on her phone's caller ID at home. To make the call, Ben had phoned the Fort Campbell switchboard, which then directed the call to their home in the Hammond Heights neighborhood on the Army Post. She didn't even say hello. "Tell me you're okay." "I'm fine. Is the team okay?" "Yes." Carla could tell he was being tight-lipped. She wanted him to say more. "Was it the battalion?" she asked. Meaning, were you guys hurt in the bombing at Kala Ijangi? Had he been hurt? "I can't say." Because of security measures, he wasn't able to tell her that he hadn't even been in the vicinity of the bombing. They talked for maybe 5 more minutes, and then Ben said he had to hang up, that he had to go to work. The lag in their conversation caused by the satellite link had been horrifying. Ben's voice had sounded like he was talking to her from underwater. She had ended up interrupting half of his sentences. But still, he was alive. She was relieved, but she had no one outside the immediate group of Special Forces wives to share the news with. Ben's being in Afghanistan was officially still secret, even though news reports had noted their presence in the country. In fact, several days earlier, President Bush had come to Fort Campbell to eat Thanksgiving dinner with the regular army troops, but as far as Carla knew, none of the Special Forces wives was invited. "Hey, what about us? My husband's over in Afghanistan fighting too," Carla thought. Then she went back to ironing the clothes and getting the kids ready for school. Span's body was retrieved and delivered to the Turkish schoolhouse, where it was stored, sealed in a blue vinyl bag, in one of the kitchen's overlarge chest freezers, adjoining the cafeteria. The body bag was wrapped in an American flag that had been presented by Mitchell's fellow teammate, Martin Homer. Homer had carried the flag into battle as a Special Forces soldier in the first Gulf War, and it had accompanied him on this last campaign. He had been honored to give it to Mike. The body was driven from the schoolhouse to the Mazar Airport, where 2 Chinook helicopters were waiting to escort it to K2. At the airport, The flag was neatly folded and presented to one of Mike's CIA colleagues, who sat in a seat on the helo and held it tightly. Helicopter pilot Greg Gibson saw that the man was nearly in tears. Span's body was loaded onto the lead bird. Sitting behind it, in his own aircraft, Night Stalker pilot Jerry Edwards, who in the last month had learned during a phone call with his wife that he was going to be a father again, watched the honor guard solemnly unfold on a video screen in his aircraft. He had turned on the helo's FLIR radar, which picked up a grainy image of the soldiers as they walked up the lead bird's ramp with Span's remains strapped to a bodyboard. Edwards and his crew had been shaken by Span's death, even though not many of them knew him well, if at all. But his death had diminished their own sense of invulnerability. They hadn't wanted to miss the ceremony, which they learned would take place in the dark, the only time when the Night Stalkers liked to fly missions. And Edwards felt lucky to have figured out how to use the FLIR to witness the moment. He sat strapped in his seat, reflecting on his own mortality and the impending birth of a new baby. At almost the same time, CIA Director George Tenet publicly announced Mike Spann's death. Mike was in the fortress of Mazar-e Sharif, where the Taliban prisoners were being held and questioned. Although these captives had given themselves up, their pledge of surrender, like so many other pledges from the vicious group they represent, proved worthless. Mike's was a career of promise in a life of energy and achievement. A precious life, given in a noble cause. Span's death soon dominated the news. President Bush issued a statement of condolence. In his hometown of Winfield, Alabama, neighbors plied his parents' house with food and sympathy. Many of the townspeople were shocked to learn that Span had worked for the CIA. A next-door neighbor would remark that Span never seemed to be home much. On Main Street, a black bow hung on the front door of the real estate office of Johnny Span, Mike's father. Flags flew at half-mast at the post office. Mr. Span held a press conference at a neighbor's home. "He was a cherished son. He was an amazing brother, a devoted father, and a loving husband. Our family wants the world to know that we are very proud of our son, Mike, and we consider him a hero." Mr. Span was near tears as he spoke. News of a CIA employee's death is usually kept a secret, with a silver star being placed afterward on the memorial wall at Langley's CIA headquarters to honor the deceased. In the case of Mike Span, he bore the grim distinction of being the first American to be killed in the first war of the 21st century, and George Tenet, as director of the CIA, took the unprecedented decision to make Span's death a matter of public record. Complicating any idea that his death might have been kept secret were the reporters who had been at the fort chronicling the uprising. Tenet had no other choice than to disclose Span's death in the melee. The effect was that Mike Span became an overnight hero, an accolade he would have shunned while alive. He became a figure of everything that a nation felt was honorable about itself, namely, selfless sacrifice, while at war with a new and mystifying threat. The further effect was to make Shannon Span the face of a nation's grief as it met this new threat. The publicity over Mike Span's death tore away the veil of secrecy that had covered her own employment as a CIA officer, and she found herself thrust before the television cameras and reporters camped outside her home in Manassas Park, Virginia. News of the Battle of Kala-i-Jangi started to make headlines around the world. Perhaps most shocking for Americans was the discovery of John Walker Lind, hunkered in the basement of the Pink House, as well as the death of a CIA paramilitary officer. Who even knew America had such men fighting in Afghanistan? Back in Marin County, California, Lynn's mother, Marilyn, logged onto the internet when she heard news that an American had been discovered in Afghanistan. She had a sinking feeling it might be John, and this feeling was confirmed when she happened upon a photo of him at the fortress. Yet Marilyn was shocked. She had never expected John to get into any kind of trouble. "He knows we wouldn't have approved," his father, Frank Lind, told a reporter, one of many who would soon be descending upon the Lind household. Marilyn felt that John must have been brainwashed to have been tangled up with the Taliban. "He would freeze when confronted with danger," she said. "He's totally not streetwise." For his part, Lind was spending his days under close guard in a second-story room in the Turkish schoolhouse. But he had not been identified immediately. In fact, after emerging from the Pink House basement, wounded and dirty, he had been loaded onto a truck headed for Shebergan, 75 miles west. At Shebergan, he and the other prisoners would be housed in a large prison there. As the truck was about to leave, a reporter for Newsweek named Colin Soloway had happened to pass by and peer inside, curious about a filthy, Western-looking figure he saw hunched there in the gloom. Soloway had come to Kala-i-Jangi, like hundreds of other reporters, to report on the battle and Span's death. But now his interpreter had approached him and said that an American was on board one of the trucks. Soloway found the bed of the vehicle filled with moaning, bleeding men. He was amazed that any of them had survived the bombs that had been aimed at the fortress. The young man in question was dressed in a black tunic and blue sweater. He was covered with dirt. His face looked as if it had been burned. One of the truck's guards tapped Soloway and motioned again at the prisoner. He insisted that he was an American. "Are you American?" Soloway asked the young man. "Yeah," he replied. This struck Soloway as unusual, indeed shocking. He asked Lind his feelings about the attacks in America, which had taken place some 11 weeks earlier. Did he support this action? Groggy, speaking slowly, Lind replied, "That requires a pretty long and complicated explanation. I haven't eaten for 2 or 3 days, and my mind is not really in shape to give you a coherent answer." Soloway asked again for his opinion. "Yes, I supported it," Lind said. Accompanying Soloway was translator Najib Qureshi, who earlier in the month had hosted Dean at his home, and a French photographer named Damien de Gildre, who recounted the surreal encounter this way. Earlier in the day, one of the survivors of the fighting in the fort had come up from the basement of the Pink House, asking if their lives would be spared if they surrendered. The local Afghan commander agreed, and they started coming out, 86 in all. "I was at the Red Cross office when they received a radio call saying survivors had been discovered. I tried catching Alex Perry of Time, but couldn't find him. Then I caught a taxi and drove straight to Kala-i-Jangi. That's where I met Najib, who said there was an American within the prisoners." Lind was sitting in the front of a truck with some of the others. Being an American, Soloway engaged in conversation with Lind, while I stood filming nearby. Lind wasn't too keen to be filmed. I didn't really want to interview him, as I felt these guys were coming back from hell. They looked completely in shock. I felt the visual of this young American with his long hair and beard and his face covered in dirt was really amazing. The image was talking for him. I still believe he was in shock when he answered Soloway's questions. It is true that he answered yes when he was asked if he was approving of the September 11 attacks. But he didn't focus on this matter or extend the discussion. He was embarrassed. I also perfectly remember his answer when he was asked why he came to Afghanistan. He said it was the most ideal Islamic republic in the world, the purest. That same night, Colin Soloway's interview was out on Newsweek's website. When we finally made it to Sherbaghan prison the next day, it was too late. The U.S. Special Forces had taken him. In fact, after Lind had arrived at Sherbaghan, one of Dostum's aides had talked with the young man and discovered that he could speak English. He immediately informed Dostum that there was a captured American in his midst. As medic Bill Bennett was treating the dehydrated, starving Lind, the moment was recorded by video camera. A CNN freelancer, Robert Pelton, conducted an interview during the medical exam. And once the video appeared on television, John Walker Lind's odyssey from California to the Kalaijangi Fortress became worldwide news. Among those watching the broadcast of the medical examination were Frank and Marilyn Lind. They hadn't seen or heard any sign of their son for 7 months. They had believed he was in Pakistan, where he had told them he'd been studying Arabic at an austere, demanding madrasa. The sight of him on television, shirtless and emaciated-looking, crushed them. Soon, the crank phone calls and death threats started to come in. Great parenting job. You should be shot with the same gun used to shoot your son. Frank Lind, a lawyer for Pacific Gas and Electric in San Francisco, had been proud of his son's disciplined study of Arabic and Islam. But he had never imagined John was in Afghanistan, fighting with the Taliban. When he saw his son on television, he broke down crying. Not long after Mike Spann's death, Shannon received a package from one of Mike's former colleagues. It was a series of tattered, charred pages from his journal. The morning he was killed, Mike had parked their truck in the fortress and walked with Dave Olson to the southern courtyard to interrogate the prisoners. Inside the truck was a journal he'd been keeping. In the airstrikes that followed, as Major Mitchell fought to quell the uprising, the truck was blown up. Shannon now held what was left of the charred journal. "One thing has troubled me," Mike had written as he rode north to Mazar. "I'm not afraid of dying, but I have a terrible fear of not being with you and our son. I think about holding you and touching you. I also think about holding that round boy of ours." 5 days after leaving Afghanistan, Spann's body arrived at Andrews Air Force Base by military transport. Shannon, along with Mike's family, went on board to view the coffin in private. The casket was then carried to a waiting hearse, while Shannon and the family watched tearfully. Johnny Spann, Mike's father, was consumed by grief. Mike, trying to prepare his father for the dangerous, clandestine nature of his work, had always warned, "Daddy, don't ever believe I'm dead until you see my body." Shortly before Mike's burial in Arlington National Cemetery, Mr. Spann visited his son one last time. He stood at the casket and gazed down. He touched Mike's forehead. He then lifted his boy's head, bent down, and looked. He saw two holes in Mike's skull. He lowered the head back down on the satin pillow and looked at his son's temples. There was a hole on each side. He figured the bullets had entered there, and exited at the two wounds he saw at the back of the head. He touched his son's arms and legs and studied them. They were bruised. He wondered if Mike had been tortured. The wounds told him nothing. Back in Mazar, Mark Mitchell could not help but remember the very moment that the fighting in Kala-i-Jangi had stopped. He had surveyed the smoking rubble, a dusty M4 in his hand, barely able to stand after fighting for his life for 7 straight days. Dead and dying men and wounded horses had littered the courtyard, a twitching choir that brayed and moaned in the rough, knee-high grass. The horses killed first had swollen to twice their size. The fort's mud floor was spongy with blood. Mitchell's buddies were equally wrung out. With every nerve jangling, Major Kurt Sontag stumbled upstairs in the schoolhouse and told Doc McFarland, "Give me something." Whatever it was, Sontag was soon out cold and slept for a day. The schoolhouse was filled with men who'd been pushed beyond their limits. They had come within minutes of losing the entire war in Afghanistan. That was the scary thing, thought Mitchell. That was the really scary thing. And yet they had prevailed. Mitchell had been part of the first U.S. cavalry attack of the 21st century. A feat trumpeted in news photos showing bearded Americans riding across a sunlit Afghanistan plain. It was as if warriors from the future had been transported to an earlier century, General Tommy Franks later remarked. On November 14, 2003, Mitchell found himself standing uncomfortably at a podium at Special Operations Command back in Florida. That day, USA Today had carried the headline, "Soldier to Receive Honor for Valor in Afghanistan." Major Mark Mitchell doesn't like to talk about what happened in Afghanistan in late November 2001, ran the story. But the Army thinks it's a pretty big deal. Mitchell stood at attention as General Brian D. Brown, commander of Special Operations Command, pinned his uniform with a Distinguished Service Cross for extraordinary heroism. The audience was a mix of family and colleagues from the covert world of Special Operations, America's brain trust in the war on terror. Mitchell's parents had arrived from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Mike Spann's wife, Shannon, sat near the front, fighting tears. Mitchell's wife tended 2 fidgeting daughters, who knew their father better as someone who read them Goodnight Moon, and then was gone for months out of the year. Emceeing the ceremony was a former Delta Force commander, Brigadier General Gary Harrell, who had survived the harrowing 1993 fight in Mogadishu, Somalia. Harrell described the 96 hours of fighting that Mitchell and the men of the 5th Special Forces Group had endured as the most intense urban combat conditions to date in Operation Enduring Freedom. General Brown described Mitchell's task as mission impossible. "The fortress was nearly impregnable," recounted Brown. 17 warriors attacked on what on a good day would have involved thousands of soldiers. Balding, smiling, looking more like a high school biology teacher than a stone-cold killer, Mitchell was suddenly the most famous soldier in America. Pretty good, he thought, for a kid from Milwaukee who had nearly quit Special Forces a year earlier. A handful of men had gotten on wild horses and defeated the Taliban. Mitchell had to laugh. He remembered the day when he couldn't even ride a horse. Epilogue. After the victory in Mazar and the Battle of Kala-i-Jangi, combat operations in northern Afghanistan began to wind down. The Taliban were beaten, and the Northern Alliance was in control. Conventional U.S. Army and Marine forces soon arrived in large numbers and began the long-term effort to secure the country and hunt down Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. The epic success of the horse soldiers, as they were dubbed, was stunning by both historical and contemporary standards. The campaign is, in fact, a template for the way the present war and future ones should be fought. Instead of large-scale occupations, we should rely on small units of special forces who have proved it's infinitely more effective to work with a country's soldiers and citizens at eye level. The SF soldiers believe that we must now resolve the root problems plaguing Afghanistan. They are uniquely trained and equipped to do just that. At the time of the capture of Mazar-i-Sharif, there were fewer than 50 U.S. military personnel like Nelson and Dean on the ground. They accomplished in 2 months what Pentagon planners had said would take 2 years. In all, about 350 Special Forces soldiers, 100 CIA officers, and 15,000 Afghan troops succeeded, where the British in the 19th century and the Soviets in the 1980s had failed. Between October 19, 2001, when Captain Mitch Nelson's team landed in Afghanistan, and the early months of 2002, when Nelson and other Special Forces teams left the country for good, the United States would eventually spend a mere $70 million to defeat an army of 50,000 to 60,000 Taliban fighters. The story of the horse soldiers was not unlike a Western, featuring high-tech lasers rather than six-shooters, fought on horseback. It's as if the Jetsons had met the Flintstones, Special Forces soldier Ben Milo said to me. The political victory proved just as overwhelming as the military one. To this day, al-Qaeda still considers the campaign their largest, most destructive defeat, Dean explained. American military planners and Afghan leaders like General Dostum and General Atta had taken great pains to make sure that the war remained the Afghans' war, and not one of American occupation. Local Afghans hailed Nelson and Dean as liberators. In 2001, as hostilities began, the Taliban had little base of support among local people, and when their leadership began to collapse, they had nowhere to retreat. They couldn't blend into the countryside and fight an insurgency from there. By entering Afghanistan with a small force, and by aligning themselves with groups that once had been battling each other and pointing them in one direction at the Taliban, U.S. forces found robust support among Afghans. They proved the usefulness of understanding and heeding the wants and needs of an enemy, and the local population that may support it. Awareness is the soldier's number one tool in his kit, beside his M4 rifle. To win wars against enemies like the Taliban, which are often stateless in their affiliation, you adapt. You eat what they eat, sleep where they sleep, and think like they think. The information and insight gained from this was the essence of the Special Forces soldiers' training and experience. As the Chinese general Sun Tzu wrote in the 6th century BC, to win 100 victories in 100 battles is not the acme of skill. To subdue the enemy without fighting is the acme of skill. Sergeant Sam Diller, part of Nelson's team, carried this aphorism in a notebook, and he read it often while atop his mountain lookout. The success of the mission was about as perfect an execution of guerrilla force as could be studied, reflected the commander of U.S. Special Forces at Fort Bragg, Major General Jeffrey Lambert. Unfortunately, said Lambert, it may never be repeated. His words would prove prescient. On December 10, 2001, Nelson and his men had to suddenly leave their safe house in Mazar and Afghanistan. They would not return as soldiers, riding at Dostum's side. For all intents,